Carlton, welcome to Atwood Unleashed. How are you, sir?
Hi, I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent. I'm really looking forward to a nice change of pace here on a topic that I know absolutely nothing about. So you'll have to forgive I'm going to say wide-eyed curiosity, but it'll probably sound like stupid questions to you. So I mean,
no such thing as a stupid question.
That's good
They're
to hear.
The hardest ones to answer. Yeah.
We'll see how you feel in the next 25 minutes about saying. Sure, but maybe you can just let our viewers and listeners know what it is you do, what keeps you busy.
I'm a lecturer in social science at the University of West of Scotland in Paisley. That's kind of where I pays the rent, so to speak. I'm here to talk about a book that I co-authored the beginning of last year, which is a critical study of the county lines phenomenon, particularly in the UK and in Scotland. The county lines phenomenon being the so-called shift in the way that drug networks and drug lines operate, and they move from urban centres to peripheral, rural, mostly coastal towns to expand their markets. So we've spent my co-authors and I, James Densley and Robert McLean, we've spent last, I suppose we kind of started this long before COVID kicked in, which seems like a million years ago, looking at some of the problems with some of the county lines narrative, I suppose, particularly within kind of policy making and policing, and basically arguing that the county lines model doesn't necessarily fit all types of kind of drug dealing, and to an extent that becomes slightly problematic in the sense that it becomes a kind of standard story that's applied and used to kind of explain away perhaps other issues or other problems or dealing with criminal illicit drug behavior in inappropriate ways.
Wonderful answer. Yeah, so there's a lot to get into there for sure. So what is the kind of standard narrative on county lines? And before we get onto your findings, what would one assume to hear when asking that question?
Yeah, so I think it was 2015, the National Crime Agency provided a definition of a county line. And county lines have been bubbling under within discussions around criminology, but also policing for a few years now. And it's an idea that's filtered over, but there are very different nuances to it, but it's kind of filtered over from the States, hence the term county lines. And it's this idea that urban drug gangs, because of the saturation of markets within large urban centers, migrate to more peripheral, rural towns, villages, to set up new kind of drug markets. And essentially the standard story is they do this through exploiting vulnerable people, particularly children. So the classic narrative is that vulnerable children are identified and, I suppose, groomed into the county lines networks, where they carry drugs and cash from these urban centres, usually on public transport, trains, etc., to these peripheral kind of out of town rural areas to and establish drug markets. So we've kind of taken a slightly more critical approach to that, and particularly in the context of Scotland, where our research is conducted, the county lines model is actually, or rather the way in which drug networks operate in Scotland, because of its geography and because of, you know, there are very few large, what you'd call large urban centres, that the county lines model kind of fits the drug mark, the way that drugs have worked in Scotland for a very, very long long period. And we thought that the standardization or the characteristics that are used to describe county lines don't fit. There's a very different story there, which we've tried to uncover. It's not that we're saying that county lines don't exist, but what we're saying is that model that I've just outlined, hopefully, doesn't fit all drug networks, and it tends to a degree that becomes a kind of self-fulfilling philosophy, or you know, a self-fulfilling legacy, particularly within the way in which, importantly, the police relate to and police and regulate illicit drug use and illicit drug markets.
Okay, so I mean, what we're talking here really is kind of, you know, a criminal underworld illegal activity. How much more difficult does that make you as a topic to research, the fact that you're talking about illegal behavior here? So, I mean, how do you even find an in to investigate this? Where do you start?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And we were in a very, very fortunate and a very unique situation that one of the co-authors has connections and a background in this area, which is very unusual for particularly research in illicit drug areas, where you don't get access to the actual networks and the actual people dealing, the actual people transporting the drugs and things like that, where we did. That kind of makes our case studies quite unique. And that's solely because we were able to develop through some of the researchers having close ties, not close ties, but grew up within kind of drug areas, or areas that were kind of are known for drug use in and around Scotland, that we were able to kind of utilize those networks and utilize those relationships. So that's kind of what makes our case studies slightly unique within the area of this type of research, is that we did have face-to-face, hands-on contact with people working in these networks.
How difficult was it to earn their trust? I mean, you mentioned your co-author there already had connections in that world, but I mean, they must be, you know, these people must be, I would assume, if they've been doing this for a long time, are probably very guarded, perhaps a little bit paranoid. How do you convince them that basically your intentions are pure?
My intentions are pure. I'm not sure I would want to convince them of that, but well, basically, I didn't do that,
right?
Because I have no relationship with these individuals, so I kind of stayed out of the picture when those relationships were being built. I think kind of the trust issues, because we, as I said, some of the researchers already had ins, and that trust had already been established prior to the research taking place, in the sense that friendships were already there, or kind of credibility issues were already there. There were elements of trust that were already there, which we didn't have to kind of undertake the kind of these huge negotiations of these issues prior to the research taking place, because they'd already been established. And we made it very, very clear that all the names in the books, the towns, and they're all anonymous. So the names in the books aren't the real names of the individual. Their stories are real, and the activities that they're involved in are real, but their names are obviously not real. So it was a case of individuals like me that have no connection with these people at all, taking pretty much taking a back seat, and those researchers or those involved in the making of the book and the research who did have those very close net relations with some of these people, developing those at their own pace, at their own speed. And of course, it wasn't all plain sailing. There were individuals who didn't want to talk to us, individuals who did talk to us and then said, "You're not using," you know, which is their right to do. And we didn't. We didn't do that. We only used the material and the relationships and the interviews and the observations that that those individuals had agreed to.
Okay. Well, as I've not read the book, and I will add it to my list because it sounds fascinating to me, and it's a world I have no concept of whatsoever. So it's always going to be more interesting for that reason. But that, I suppose the kind of elephant in the room that hangs over conversations of this type is the sort of argument for the legalization of drugs. So mm-hmm. we seem to have kind of competing narratives, whichever end of the political spectrum you go to. The people would say, you know, traditionally left to far left would call for the decriminalization of drugs as a solution to, you know, gang crime, exploitation, other things in the peripherals like prostitution, things like that. Those on the sort of conservative religious right would say it's all an abomination and you need to lock these drug dealers up and throw away the key, and that'll sort out the drug problem. In your investigations for this book, have you become more sympathetic to one side more than the other? What was your takeaway on that issue?
I think it's a really fundamental question, and in some senses, although not directly, but I think in some indirectly, that's the mess that we're trying to unpack within the book to an extent. Nowhere in the book, nowhere anywhere in the kind of, do we condone illicit drug use? Do we condone kind of illicit drug market? So this isn't a justification for, you know, that kind of, I heard some of the discussion that you were having previously, and I found that really fascinating. But, and your speaker talked about the kind of victimology that surrounds the gender debate. Well, I think there's a similar victimology that very much surrounds the drug issue, both in terms of people who consume drugs, but also people who were incorporated into dealing and trafficking drugs for economic reasons. And I think one of the things that we were trying to do was puncture that victimology, to say that there is an alternative, that there is a problem with the victim narrative, in the sense that it undermines what we found, and kind of this is also true of other research, but very much in terms of our research, is that the victim model didn't fit the individuals that were, kind of involved in, and they kind of rejected that notion of themselves because it didn't fit with the way that they saw themselves. And certainly, if you kind of look at the way that drugs is talked about, illicit drug use and illicit drug markets are talked about in the kind of popular sense, particularly Hollywood and things like that, kind of, it's usually women and children that are victimized most. They're forced into dealing, they're forced into carrying drugs and things like that. But very much in the case studies that we looked at, there were some very strong women who played prominent roles in very localized drug networks, and they were far from victims. So we were also trying to puncture that, the dominance of the victim narrative within the drug stories, because I think there's a danger with the victim narrative in that it undermines the individual's responsibility for acting and taking responsibility for their actions. And you can really see that, and this is something we try and uncover and unpick in the book, is the way in which the victim narrative becomes a way of undermining more traditional notions of responsibility, accountability, rights, particularly within kind of, I suppose, what we might loosely call a kind of liberal criminal justice system, which I think personally are very, very important. So we were also trying to puncture or offer an alternative that this kind of victimology, the way in which the narrative about drugs is generally talked about, it doesn't fit, or it didn't fit our case studies, but also has slightly worrying consequences in terms of holding people account for illegal behavior, basically. So we very much wanted to try and take issue with that kind of dominant narrative, particularly in Scotland. It's a very dominant narrative around the drug issues, that kind of addiction is not necessarily the addict's fault. Kind of is. It's the addict putting the drugs in their body, so they have to be held account for that. Not to hold them account for it is very, very dangerous, because if you can't hold yourself account for your own behavior, you're going to be stuck in that loop forever. And, you know, that's a very worrying consequence, particularly when we're talking about behavior that is very, very dangerous, not only to the individual, but others around them as well.
That's a really good answer. And it's just brought to mind something, actually, and I'm not quite sure. I don't think we're really allowed to specifically name drugs at this point in a conversation on YouTube. I think just referring to them by their color might be useful. So, I mean, people, I suppose, in Scotland, you know, the brown substance that can be injected is quite popular, for instance. And there have been, you know, various initiatives, I don't know if these still exist, where addicts can go and get clean needles, because obviously the risk of certain diseases, you know, life-threatening diseases one can catch from sharing needles seems like a bigger problem than many to the actual drug use. And I just wondering, what do you feel about that as a potential solution? Is this something that kind of perpetuates the habit, or is it actually alleviating a real larger problem?
I think the case in that you're kind of drawing attention to, and particularly in Scotland, is really, really interesting, but at the same time, quite frightening. Because you mentioned the brown substance. The drug that kills most Scottish addicts is the substance that they use to substitute for the brown substance. I'm not sure. Right. A particular opioid. So more people die of a particular opioid, begin with M, and which is prescribed to them.
I think you can say that, because it's a legal drug.
Right,
I think
methadone. Okay. Methadone, yes. Kills the vast majority of drug addicts in Scotland. And although that it's very difficult, nigh impossible to get an accurate assessment of what is the legal methadone and what is illegal methadone, but methadone is the drug that is sanctioned by the state to give to addicts to get them off their other stuff. But it's the drug that they're dying from. Methadone is the drug that they're dying from. I have kind of, personally, I have no objections to allowing somebody, or providing the facilities for somebody with a very serious life-threatening addiction, to enable them to take their drug safely. However, with the proviso that the reason that you're doing that is to get them off the drug, to stop them taking the drug. So I think there is a process where these techniques can be used, but they have to be placed within a properly sanctioned, properly funded, properly legislated for system of recovery. You know, kind of, I don't want an addict to remain an addict. I don't want people to die from overdoses. However, we have in Scotland, and it's similarly in the UK more generally, and Europe more generally, I think, a kind of fetishization, or kind of an ideology built around harm reduction, that all that we can do for addicts is just to manage their addiction. So they're essentially locked into a cycle where an addict isn't allowed to be anything else. You know, so the harm reduction narrative is that recovery programs are problematic because they don't work. They set too high an expectation on the addict to overcome, or to attempt to overcome their addiction. So what we need to do is just manage their addiction, provide safe spaces, provide the technology and the paraphernalia through which they can then safely take the drug. I don't think there's no such thing as safe drug taking. you will eventually die from it. And that's what's happening. What we don't have are properly sanctioned, properly funded, or properly legislated for programs dedicated to allowing the addict to recover from their addiction. We were too bought in, or certainly the powers that be in Scotland and more broadly have bought into this kind of mantra about the low expectation, basically, that all we can do is just manage the addict's addiction. So we substitute one drug that they're addicted to for another drug, which subsequently they become addicted to and die from. So we have this fairly vicious circle that's taking place, particularly in Scotland, where addicts are dying from taking the drug that is given to them by the state in order to get them off the other drug that they were dying from. So we have this rather ridiculous kind of almost Kafkaian kind of situation. And it's tragic, really.
No, that's a really good answer. You just made me think of something there. We might be opening a can of worms here with the time we've got left, but you're saying these kind of no real, I think you said the word safe drug use. And I think that's a fair point. And I'm not sure, I know under Gordon Brown, I think he kind of, in England, I'm not sure if this applies to Scotland as well, that we have the kind of class system to rate drugs. And I think they kind of pertain to how much trouble you're getting caught in possession or dealing. And I think we had, the green one that's most typically smoked was a class C drug for the longest time, got bumped up to a class B under Gordon Brown. I think it's been a while since I've thought about this. And but this is the substance that is kind of glamorized quite a lot. Obviously, it's legal in places like Holland, various states in America now, you can get it. It's part of our pop culture. It seems like the police would almost turn a blind eye to it 9 times out of 10, mm-hmm. depending on what you're doing with it. Is there an argument here for the legalization of that particular drug? Or actually, getting on to your previous point, people will promote this particular drug as something you can't get addicted to and it's practically harmless. How would you say that kind of narrative stacks up against what you've researched?
I think you're talking about kind of drugs that are normally associated with kind of casual drug taking,
habitual drug use,
that kind of thing. I think I'm not sure you're going to like my answer because I'm going to sit on the fence a bit. I'm not necessarily for the legalization of drugs, and I'm not necessarily for the prohibition of them. I think where I'm at is people need to be held to account for taking them. If you're going to take them, take them. However, you have to pay the consequences for taking. So if it isn't a legal drug, you have to, face the sanction of the laws of the land.
Yeah, with great powder comes great responsibility.
Yeah, I think. Yes.
With great powder comes great responsibility.
Absolutely. I think that. So I'm neither a kind of advocate. I'm not an advocate of liberalization in the sense of getting away with the laws, because I think the point that you make is very apposite, because actually very rarely are the laws actually acted on. They're not, the police don't enforce them. They kind of turn a blind eye. So there's a wider question. I'm kind of avoiding your question, really, and not giving you a straight answer. There's a wider question here, which I think is kind of perhaps more important in the sense of whether we should legislate or liberalize, etc. And that's the kind of moral question about, actually, is putting drugs in your body good for society? Is the fact that you actually getting wasted every weekend, or the fact that you can't talk straight, go to work, hold down a job, is that really a good thing? Is that really what we should expect a proper society to, and a proper, an adult society, a properly responsible adult society to be about. I think there's a kind of moral question here around, which we've lost sight of, I think, which is around what type of society do we want to live in? Is it a society that says, oh yeah, you can take this, you can take that, and you're not really responsible for it because you're poor, or you had a hard life, or you're kind of, you know, you've been a victim of this and that, or you're, or do we want to say, look, you know, we value your contribution as a responsible adult, and I think that's a side of the discussion around the drugs issue, whether it's just for fun or whether it is actually a real problem, that seems to be missing or avoided. I think policymakers, politicians, experts like me, although I'm hopefully an exception, we don't like talking about morality because it smacks of kind of old-fashioned fuddy-duddy Christian, which I'm not, kind of values that, oh, we can't be having that anymore. But I think there is a moral component missing from the discussion around drugs, and particularly illicit drug taking.
That's really interesting, because like you say, the narrative has become very skewed towards the kind of victim mentality, hasn't it? You know, no other options, getting caught up in something happening to you rather than you making something happen, I suppose. And really, I mean, realistically, the only way people are going to get out of this is personal responsibility, or at least taking help when it's offered, which is a decision they have to make for sure. I mean, maybe in the minute we've got left, perhaps you can tell us a few ways in which, you know, the county lines have adapted over the years to kind of evade new tactics for drug enforcement and things like that. Has there been any like significant changes that you've seen?
Well, I think kind of it's actually the other way around. It's the law that has utilized county lines to evade taking responsibility for prosecuting people.
Right.
So like you're talking about the kind of the victimology or the narratives around victimhood. They've been sucked into the policing regimes, and so the big narrative is around vulnerability, that the people involved in county lines activity, drug networks, are vulnerable, so they can't be treated as, inverted commas, criminal. So if you look at all the kind of recent police briefings, certainly since in the last 10 years or so, they've kind of rejected, they don't talk about drug pushers anymore, drug dealers. They talk about vulnerable populations, particularly young vulnerable people. So I think it's not so much that county lines have found ways to evade the law, it's actually the law has found ways to evade the law. In terms of kind of, you know, rights and, like, the classic liberal model of the law is you're guilty or you're not guilty. But however, I think kind of there is now a situation where the law doesn't actually operate like that anymore, in the sense that it's blurred the lines between guilt and innocence. You know, kind of you're vulnerable.
Yeah,
so you're kind of neither guilty or innocent. You're just kind of in this kind of legal limbo of vulnerability. Yeah, you're not one thing or the other.
I think this is my fault. I poked at the morality issue a bit with a minute to go, Carlton, but that was a very good point, which is fascinating to me for sure. The kind of the reluctance of law to act on this now. But maybe you could let people know the title of your book again and where people can find it, please.
Yeah, it's the book is Contesting County Lines, Case Studies in Drug Crime and Deviant Entrepreneurship. It's not an academic book. It is, but it's kind of written in a very kind of open, accessible way. And it's published by Bristol University Press.
Carlton, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on and speaking to us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. That's been great. Thank you.
Take care.
Andrew.
All right, ladies and gents, and those who don't care for my antiquated gender labels, if you would like to get yourself over to Locals now to watch the next half of the show, it's completely free. We don't want anything. Just go over, get your eyeballs on it. I'm just going to wait here while you do that again. All right, we're going to bring in our next guest. Nicholas, welcome to Outward Unleashed. How are you?
Hi, Steve. I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. So,